Bruckner's 8th Symphony here at the Royal Albert Hall. Jaap van Zweden conducted the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra. Jaap van Zweden was saying to me just before the rehearsal that a good hall demands Bruckner, a hall like the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, he said, or like the Royal Albert Hall here, and surely this space was made for that music, made for music like the final 5 minutes, especially of Bruckner's 8th Symphony. Jaap van Zweden bringing the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic's principal horn to her feet, Petra Bokma, and the whole horn section, four of them playing horns, four of them playing Wagner tubas at the end of Bruckner's 8th Symphony. The principal trumpet, Hessel Boomer, and indeed the trombone, Herman Naas. All of those soloists really in that gigantic brass section, eight horns, four trumpets, three trombones, tuba, triple woodwind, three harps, and a huge complement of strings. Jaap van Zweden brings the rest of his orchestra, the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic, to their feet, and the orchestra, he and the orchestra embarked on a recorded cycle of Bruckner's symphonies, installments still to come though, including this one, the 8th. Looking forward to that a lot, I have to say. So extraordinary, that music that Bruckner writes at the end of that symphony, when the themes that we've been listening to for the last 80 minutes come together in one contrapuntal single texture. It's as if you can experience the whole symphony in one point. Time seems to both expand and to stand still. Jaap van Zweden comes on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. It's an increasingly tumultuous reception he's getting from the orchestra and the Royal Albert Hall here, the full Royal Albert Hall. Well, more proms to enjoy tomorrow. A world premiere from Graham Fitkin, a cello concerto that Yo-Yo Ma will play. BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by David Roberts. And then in the second half, the annual appearance of Beethoven's 9th Symphony. All that to come. And a proms portrait, a composer portrait that I'll be doing with Graham Fitkin that you can hear after tomorrow's prom. But now, though, with the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic on their feet, quite a lot of the Royal Albert Hall too, even the audience in the arena too. Time to hand you back to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
And that was Tom Service presenting tonight's prom live from the Royal Albert Hall. You can hear it again online, of course, for the next 7 days, or again here on BBC Radio 3 on Thursday afternoon at 2:30.
She made her BBC Proms debut a decade ago. Now she returns to London's Royal Albert Hall to play the same work in 2011. Pianist Hélène Grimaud plays Beethoven's evergreen 4th piano concerto in the first of a pair of concerts by the Pittsburgh Symphony and its current music director, Manfred Honeck. I'm Susie Klein. Join me this Monday night at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, our next programme this evening on Radio 3 is our feature, Robert Schumann and the Music of the Future. And that's just under 30 minutes away at 10:15. So, in the meantime, let's stay in a sound world that Bruckner would have been familiar with, music for organ. This is something with a difference, music for violin and organ. 6 pieces, Opus 150, by Josef Rheinberger. Christopher Herrick as the organist, Paul Barrett the violinist.
Thank you. Thank you.
The six pieces for violin and organ, Opus 150 by Josef Rheinberger, ending rather curiously perhaps with an overture. Paul Barrett was the violinist, Christopher Herrick the organist, and in case you like to know these things, that recording was made on the Frobenius organ of All Saints Parish Church in my hometown of Kingston-upon-Thames. This is BBC Radio 3. 20 past 10 is the time now, and a few minutes later than advertised, we come to our feature tonight, Robert Schumann and the Music of the Future. The music Schumann wrote in the 1850s, in the last few years of his life, has always been the subject of debate. Undoubtedly different from his earlier music, to some it's clearly the product of a diseased mind and represents a tailing off of creativity. Others view these works as the fruits of a consciously new, even modern, compositional direction. The cellist Stephen Isserlis has long been a keen advocate of Schumann's late music, and he sets out now to discover more about the forces that shaped it. We join him in Düsseldorf.
I'm standing by the Rhine at a point, must be very near, where early one morning in late February 1854, Schumann climbed over the boats, the pontoon bridge across the river, and then threw himself in. Some fishermen rescued him. He tried to jump back in, but they wouldn't let him. It's all the more poignant to think that the Rhine was the inspiration for one of his most joyous works, the Rhenish Symphony, written just 3.5 years earlier. And then he was taken back from here, back to his house in Bilkestrasse, and was jeered at by people celebrating a carnival. Again, the title of one of his earlier, most ecstatic pieces. It's as if he was preparing through his life to be the subject of a Hollywood movie. It's also ironic somehow.
Man in some ways. You know, he was almost silent for most of his life. Isn't that strange for someone who wrote so much and who expressed so much in his music? It's as if the music was a form of speech for him.
If you think about what would have happened to Schumann today, had he been in a situation, medically speaking, that he was, he wouldn't have spent his last 2 years in an asylum. the fact that that was his fate means that history has made us approach him in a particular way, and it's very difficult to listen to his late music and not automatically hear signs of failing. We can't help that. We know too much.
Okay, the music is different, and I think the people around him, they feel there's a distance, there's another sound, there's another world, and they have problems with that. For me, this other world is the world in which the future lives. I cannot speak about this world, but I can feel it.
I've always adored Schumann, the composer, and Schumann the man. I feel some sort of special identification with him, and I can never explain why. People often ask me, why Schumann? And all I can do is shrug and say, how does one choose one's best friends, one's partners? Generous, he was kind, he was noble, and his music is infinitely beautiful, infinitely vulnerable, probably more autobiographical than that of any other composer. The story of the last few years of his life is awful. He had that suicide attempt into the Rhine, then he spent 2.5 ghastly years in an asylum in Bonn, and there's really no bright side to it. It's just tragic. And unfortunately, because that story has become so famous, the whole of the story of his later life has become permeated with the idea that he was descending into madness, and people judge the music, the late music, on that basis, which I think is a big mistake. His widow Clara even destroyed one of his very last pieces, 5 Romances for Cello and Piano, because she felt it would show him in an unfavourable light. Here I want to talk to other musicians who play the late music and understand the late music in their own different ways and share my passion for Schumann. His life began in Zwickau and then took him to Leipzig and Dresden, but our story starts in Dusseldorf on the 1st of September 1850, when Schumann was just 40. Schumann biographer John Werthen.
He's gone to Dusseldorf for a very particular reason. He needs a job. For the first time in his life, he and Clara clearly made a joint decision. They cannot go on living off savings the way they have been doing all their married life. Although Schumann is writing and publishing more music and getting more income from it by the late 1840s, he still needs a job. So he goes to Düsseldorf. And for the first time, the Schumann family goes into the black in the early 1850s. What he also has the chance to do is play an orchestra.
It wasn't such a great orchestra, though. Here's conductor John Elliott Gardner.
It was very different, evidently, from the Gewandhaus Orchestra in Leipzig that had a very good disposition towards Schumann. I mean, I think that's mostly due to Mendelssohn and Ferdinand David, the leader, who was a great supporter. He seemed to have got on with them, but then he didn't make a profession of it then. It seems to me one needs to factor in this crucial watershed in his life, the moment when Schumann enters the harsh, unsavoury world of professional music.
It's a reasonable town to move to. People like Mendelssohn have worked there before, but it's not a prime job. It's not the one he wanted in Leipzig or even the opera house job he wanted in Dresden where he was before. It's more of a backwater. He's having to deal with the dilettantes. So there are various shifts in Schumann's career at this point, which means that people start to think he's entering a new period. Also, this is the age of music criticism, and people are very historically aware of what happens to a composer through his career. So you have people writing about the kind of things Schumann's doing and noting when he's changing tack, when he's turning to particular poets, when he's turning to particular forces, and they think about how that develops through the decades. There is a sense in which 1850 is definitely a turning point for him on a personal level. He is quite prolific, and in many ways you can see the move to Düsseldorf, at least at first, as being quite a good move for him, that he does produce a lot of music for the new circumstances he finds himself in, and it seems as if this could be a new start for him that could be very fruitful.
Laura Tunbridge. Schumann was very prolific in Düsseldorf, in fact. A third of his output comes from those years. The cello concerto, the violin concerto, choral ballads, songs, piano music, chamber music, a requiem, a mass, and so on. He was a busy man. He wrote very quickly, as he always had. As we've heard, people around him noticed that he was changing. His style was changing, his whole aesthetic seemed to be changing somehow. But what is it that links early and late Schumann? John Elliott Gardiner.
He has this burning desire to allow music to be both an intensely private experience and yet to have a public face. And that involves contradictions in itself. Then he has this almost political, philosophical agenda to make orchestral abstract music the equivalent in its emotive and expressive power to that of a novel, so that music has a narrative burden and a narrative function in a way that perhaps only Beethoven really, really, amongst his predecessors, understood. And that was a constant all through his life, whether he was writing for piano solo or for chamber music, or indeed on a much larger scale.
We're talking about an age which is very much concerned with building nationhood, an idea of what it meant to be German, of what German music should be, what should happen post-Beethoven. There's a tension with Schumann, even at this point, between the way he is as a man, which in some ways was quite difficult, quite taciturn, quite reserved, not someone who was good at dealing with large groups of people, which would come to be an issue in Düsseldorf. But at the same time, he's writing large-scale choral works. He's setting texts by people like Ludwig Uhland, who are involved in the kind of 1848 uprisings. So there's a divide between what he's doing as a composer, which is very much a public voice, and what he was like in his personal life.
Among the works he wrote in the Düsseldorf years, and the more public works, in fact, are some choral ballads based on ancient German legends. It's probably as close as he gets to Wagner, this music, very pan-Germanic.
They're interesting pieces, but I think their day is still to come. I don't think that they've yet been put in the spotlight sufficiently for us to be able to evaluate their strengths and their weaknesses. There are certain slightly cringe-making aspects to the patriotism involved in his choice of poems. But beneath that is a tremendous cultural belief in Germany that since the time of Bach, really, German musical culture had not lived up to its early reputation.
Well, yes, I can see what he means by cringe-making, but I think it's only cringe-making, really, in the context of history. I don't think he was nationalist in any negative sense at all. And when the 1848 uprisings came, Wagner was there manning the barricades, and Schumann just fled and wrote some of his most private music, some chamber music, which is sort of intensely personal and dreamy. Wagner was, of course, a key player, maybe the key player, in the search for a new direction for German music, what became known as the music of the future. Laura Tunbridge again.
Essentially, it's something that critics concoct around these composers, and it has a political edge to it in the sense that it's a post-revolutionary period, but also in the sense they're trying to build up different musical schools. So you have, in the early 1850s, an idea of the Mendelssohn School, even though Mendelssohn's no longer around, existing in Leipzig. You have Liszt in Weimar, and you have Schumann in Dusseldorf. And you have bands of followers and critics supporting them and arguing against them. And this becomes more and more virulent throughout the 1850s and for the rest of the 19th century. One of the things that it's important to remember is that Liszt is known primarily for his programmatic music, his tone poems, as well as obviously all the piano music, but his tone poems are really what they're talking about, and this idea of programmatic music being able to convey a narrative or a story. And you also have Wagner promoting music drama, opera, as the way to succeed Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And one of the problems Schumann has in that debate is that, okay, he's writing these choral works and songs and so forth, but actually he's known primarily for instrumental music and for writing in small forms and for not dealing with the kind of gargantuan scale of works that Liszt and Wagner are associated with. So he doesn't quite fit in with the music of the future idea. That said, some of what he does and the nationalist impulse, which we forget about for the most part, and some of his musical devices, the way he writes for voices and so forth, are actually more in keeping with what Wagner and Liszt do. So he's a funny in-between character. The Romantic generation is gone, and he isn't quite in keeping with the people who are taking it over.
Pianist Graham Johnson has spent a lifetime in the world of the art song, which means he spent a lifetime with Schumann. He has his own very particular views on the later Schumann songs.
There's a very emotional agenda in the late Schumann songs. He seems, for example, to be incredibly concerned with creatures of misfortune. The texts of the late Schumann songs all concern people who have suffered some terrible misfortune, particularly women. Elisabeth Kuhlmann, the Russian-German poetess who lived in St. Petersburg, he writes these songs, very, very simple songs, very spare on the page, but also writes biographical introductions to each of them in his own words, describing how sad it was that she died at such an early age, even though she was so gifted and so prolific. There is a feeling sometimes that he feels himself very unfortunate and caught in some type of web of illness and dysfunction, and that he has enormous sympathy in some way in choosing his texts. On the other hand, let's face it, the texts are by poets that are less distinguished than usual. Farius is a poet who comes in, Titus Ulrich, Kinkel, poets that don't concern him in other periods of his life. And that's where I think he may be actually doing something deliberate for other reasons. What fascinates me is what he seems to be struggling for that he doesn't actually completely incandescently achieve sometimes, which is an alternative to Wagner. I think he's struggling to find something that is a riposte to the way that Wagner sets words to music. But that's my theory anyway.
It's funny, I've never really thought of Wagner as being a particularly important figure in Schumann's life. There's certainly not that much in Schumann's letters about him. But, you know, Wagner was full of seething jealousy and Schumann was the opposite, full of seething generosity. So who knows? I don't think Graham would agree with me anyway.
I think that Wagner actually occupied Schumann's mind rather more than one thinks, particularly with Lohengrin, Rienzi, and those pieces that were done in Dresden when Schumann was there. Admittedly, there was no further contact when he went to Dusseldorf. But I think he had quite a lot to think of. I mean, Wagner's arrogance and Wagner's early successes, he was on the way up in the late 1840s and 1850s, having actually led a very undistinguished existence in Paris and all the rest of it. How do you express musical nationalism? Is it through Lohengrin and Nibelung Saga? Or is it through folk song, through a simplicity of speech that is more associated less with melody, more with speech rhythms? Could he have taken something from Wagner so that these gorgeous flowing melodies in the songs become less important to him? Instead, he actually wants something that is more truthful to the inflection of speech. And does he choose his indifferent poems because he can freely adapt them in a way that you can't adapt Goethe and you can't adapt Eichendorff?
Graham Johnson. John Elliott Gardner is a bit more sceptical about Wagner and Schumann.
To what extent Schumann was under Wagner's shadow in the way he composed, I don't think is easy to estimate. I would suggest that it was less than that of Brahms. I think Brahms was, to some extent, writing against Wagner, whereas Schumann, being earlier, was his own man. It's just that later on, interpreters of Schumann symphonies, as with Brahms symphonies, tended to wrongly, in my view, associate Wagner's sound world with that of Schumann and Brahms. Hence all the problems of thick orchestration and lack of colour that conductors have complained about and therefore tried to tinker with in order to make it more lucid. It's all a question of size and proportion, that Wagner's sound world was so much more massive than that of Schumann or Brahms's. And when you scale their music down to the proportions in Brahms's case of the Meiningen Orchestra, and in Schumann's case to that of the first performances with the Gewandhaus Orchestra of the First and Fourth Symphonies, you come to a totally different conclusion.
John Elliott Gardner. It's 1851 and Schumann's been in Dusseldorf for a year. His first year in Dusseldorf was an almost complete success. He was happy with the orchestra, happy with the choir, and they were happy with him. Second year, he started having more physical, presumably mental problems, wasn't able to do all his concerts because of weakness and probably depression. In the third year, things started to go very seriously wrong. John Werthen takes up the story.
His relationship with the choir almost disintegrates, and Schumann himself finds it increasingly difficult to cope with the choir and the orchestra. His fourth year is the disaster, starting in the autumn of 1853. And now he can't actually work with the orchestra either. There's an awful moment in a concert in a church in September 1853 when he goes on conducting after the music has stopped. That is, he's not actually hearing the music that's being played. He's conducting the music he hears in his head.
Well, the music he was hearing in his head was probably an awful lot better than the music was coming out from the Dusseldorf Orchestra. Pianist Anders Schiff is a fellow Schumaniac.
Schumann had a dream that the spirits of Schubert and Mendelssohn appeared in his dream and they dictated this theme to him. It's a wonderful theme. The tragic side of this is that Schumann had forgotten that he had already written this theme before, in the slow movement of the violin concerto and also in a certain way in the F major string quartet. But he had forgotten that. And so he wrote down the theme as dictated by the spirits of Schubert and Mendelssohn. That's why it's called the Geistervariation and the variations of the spirits. He wrote down the first three variations and then he stormed out of his house in Düsseldorf and he had his suicide attempt. He jumped into the icy river, the River Rhine. Some fishermen saw this happening and saved him. They caught him and brought him back to the house, and he was shivering. And then subsequently he wrote two more variations, number 4 and 5, and that was it before he was taken to the asylum.
So now I've come to Endenich, which is the house which was an asylum, where Schumann spent the last 2.5 years of his life. And from the description of the view, I think this was probably his room. And this room has a very sad atmosphere to it, I think. I don't think I'm imagining it. Very low ceilings and sort of, I don't know, I'm already feeling quite claustrophobic, and I've only been here a few minutes. It's now a little miniature museum. There's the tiny little manuscript of the Geistervariationen. I thought it would be sort of on big, at least A3 paper, but it's not. It's very small. It's more like letter-sized paper. And then there's the chorales he wrote when he was in Endenich. We don't know when. And there's one that's complete, which is very appropriately, and I'm sure it's no coincidence, it's when my hour of departure comes, I shall be prepared. And then it goes into another chorale, and that just breaks off. And then there's a copy of his very last letter to Clara, which I suppose is probably his last letter to anybody. It's very neat handwriting, unlike his earlier writing, which was quite a mess. This is obviously done with great care and probably great difficulty. And there's some of Schumann's hair. It's rather amazing. Doesn't seem to have gone grey, even though he was in his late 40s. Lucky him. And over here is what I suppose was his piano. It's a small instrument, sort of a table piano. I guess this is what... There was very sad descriptions of him improvising, like a mechanical doll with broken strings. So here it is, made by Richard Lipp of Stuttgart. And pictures of Brahms, Joachim, Clara in middle age. And not much else. It's a lonely little room. One can sort of imagine Schumann pacing around. One can read from the medical notes. There were times he was violent and had to be restrained. And other times when I think he seemed quite normal. But God, to be stuck in this room for 2.5 years. And then, of course, this death, even at his death, there was nobody there. He was all by himself.
The last variation to me is one of the most touching moments in Schumann, and I can just see an image that went on in his head. It's like being in a middle of a beehive. It's almost pointillistic, little dots and points, and some kind of a picture emerges out of that. Is this a fragment? Is this something unfinished? I'm not sure. To me, it's complete. It's perfect in its incompleteness. If he wanted to write something more, I don't see what else he could have said. So to me, this is not the fragment, but it's a final document, maybe.
This is the death notice when Schumann had died from his old newspaper, the Neue Zeitschrift für Musik. Robert Schumann died on the 29th of July in Endenich, near Bonn, His wife, Joachim, Brahms, and Dietrich were present at his funeral. As irreplaceable and painful as the loss is, it hardly comes as a surprise to anyone. In view of the nature of his illness and considering all that was known about his situation, there was little improvement from the very beginning. We have provided news about his condition only extremely rarely, and when we did, talked about improvements that were hardly believed to be possible. Even when the first sad news about his illness became known, we only hinted at it for no other reason than our journal was sent to him continuously, and thus we had to be very careful. Until his resignation from this journal, he was mainly recognised as a bel triste. Now nearly the whole public is convinced of what only a few felt positive about when we took over. Schumann has accomplished things immortal, and the history of art views him as one of Beethoven's greatest successors. That's interesting, especially because it implies that his reputation in his later years was much, much stronger than in his earlier years. It's funny that now his early music tends to be more popular than his later music. Obviously not the case then. That was a temporary mistake of history, confusing his madness with his late works.
I think that for the serious critics, for those who survived him, for Liszt, for instance, it was his music that remained important. And I honestly don't think they distinguished between the later music and the earlier music. They didn't see him as an artist in decline because they had these great works. They had Faust, which was composed throughout his life, but mostly in the later period, and that was performed, and the symphonies and the concertos. So I don't see contemporaries separating his life's work in the way that we're talking about now.
Judith Chernick. Yeah, it's interesting, always very interesting to read his contemporaries' accounts of his works as they were written. One, of course, has to make allowances for people being polite to somebody who's still there. But I do think there was a genuine enthusiasm for his later music that was in posthumous years to be coloured by the story of his mental decline. Clara. Well, it's unlikely that a cellist is going to be a great Clara fan because she destroyed those five romances for cello and piano, which is the greatest crime in cellistic history. But she's very much a controversial figure.
Clara devoted her life to making his music widely known in the great world. And she started this right after he was admitted to Endenich Asylum, that is, right after the birth of their last child. She disposed of the children in various ways. She left one with her mother. She put two into boarding school. She had nurses and maids for the others. And she toured. She toured in London. She toured all over Germany. And everywhere she went, she performed Schumann's music. But she didn't perform all of it. She performed the works which she believed were accessible for the public. And this meant that she'd play three of the Carnival pieces and her own selection of works. And of course, she played Schumann's works along with works by Beethoven and Mozart and Bach. She and Brahms collaborated on the great edition of Schumann's work, the complete works. And they collaborated and they discussed everything, and they both were devoted to preserving his legacy. And it must be that when they came to this set of pieces for cello, she must have just made the decision, probably herself, to withhold it, to destroy it. I think from her own point of view, and she was a very astute reader of Schumann's music, they probably weren't worthy of his legacy, but we can't know about that.
We certainly can't. Brahms and Joachim loved them at the time, and she also probably destroyed the fair copy of the third violin sonata, but she wasn't to know that a full sketch had survived, and so we now have the third violin sonata, and for me it's a masterwork. Anyway, there are several reasons why Clara might have taken against Schumann's late music, partly just the association with the terrible suffering. It was a nightmare for her, as well as for him, those years of madness. And then, I think, for her, Mendelssohn was probably a much more ideal composer than Schumann. Her own music certainly sounds much more like Mendelssohn. And Mendelssohn was almost always writing for a specific audience. His pieces are wonderful concert music, and Schumann's just not like that. I think that her neglect of Schumann's late music was largely responsible for the bad reputation it garnered. Graham Johnson again.
are we also not dealing with a sense of Biedermeier quasi-Victorian respectability that is spreading its net through the whole of Europe? And revisionism and only showing the respectable side of things is actually becoming more and more part of a society which it hadn't been in the 1820s and 30s, which were much freer. So rewriting history, the side of the widow that wants her husband only to be remembered in the best possible light, strangling stories that showed him not to be respected. This is such a common thing. There is something staid and rather calcified creeping into society. And I think that Clara was aware that any evidence of this illness, any piece of music that would get people talking about illness, would have to be removed. The fact of the matter, Stephen, you're the one who's an authority on publication dates. Am I not right in saying that Schumann had already published quite a lot of his late stuff?
Oh, yes.
And the chances are that if he'd just left it unpublished, that more would have been suppressed.
Absolutely. The Requiem, Opus 148, was only saved because he'd completely revised it for publication. Clara wanted to get rid of it, and Brahms said, no, this was prepared for publication. He wanted it published. We must spare it. It's beautiful, the Requiem.
Schumann actually was so well known to publishers that he could get quite a quick turnaround in the last years. He didn't pile up things in his last years and keep them for publication. I would bet that the Opus 107 songs and some of the Opus 125 songs and so on, these late songs, they wouldn't have even seen the light of day if they hadn't already been sent to the publisher.
And that would have been a huge loss.
Yes, it would have actually meant, however, that we wouldn't be having this discussion. But not having this discussion and not talking about a possible decline is precisely what Clara's aim was. You can see that in terms of controlling history, what she wanted was him to be seen in his glory days.
And, as she saw them.
As she saw them, yes.
She couldn't control history, though. Rumours about Schumann's personal situation started to gather momentum in the months after his death, starting with the appearance in 1858